We're holding on Yud Ches Amud Beis, the third line from the bottom. Now, the Mishnah had listed a bunch of things that the Kohen Gadol does and doesn't do. The reason what's the reason why that comes into our Masechta is because in the first parak we learned that the Kohen Gadol, when he's going to be judged, if he's going to be judged with a matter of Dinei Nefashos, it's judged by the Beis Din of 71. So then, by the way, then it goes into dealing with various other dinim of the Kohen Gadol and of the king also. And then after that, we're going to get back to the main topics of Masechta Sanhedrin. So the Mishnah had said that a Kohen Gadol can be a member of the Beis Din, and he can be tried by Beis Din. He can say Eidos, and they say Eidos about him, which the Gemara before had dealt with certain details of that. It's not that always he goes to give Eidos, only when it involves the king, out of respect for the king, etc. Anyway, the Mishnah had mentioned also. The Mishnah had said that a Kohen Gadol can do chalitza, and if he dies, then chalitza is done for his wife. Now, if he dies, yibum can be done with his wife. However, the Mishnah had said the Kohen Gadol cannot do yibum because he's not allowed to marry an almana, and by definition, a yavama is an almana. So the Gemara points out, kaposik v'tani. Now the Mishnah is saying as a blanket statement, lo shna min erusin v'lo shna min nisuin. It doesn't matter whether she's widowed from erusin or nisuin. Now you think about it, nisuin, of course, the Kohen Gadol has a mitzvah. So there's two things. A Kohen Gadol has a mitzvah not to marry an almana, but he also has a mitzvah to marry a besula. So now, if she's min hanisuin, if it's after nisuin, then of course she's both. She's an almana and not a besula. If it's min erusin, then it's only one. She's an almana, but she's still a besula. So, b'shleima min hanisuin, I can understand why, if she's widowed after nisuin, have an esse v'lois hese. At that point, for him to marry her, to do yibum with her, would be an esse and a lois. He'd be violating an esse and a lois hese. The esse because she's not a besula, and the lois hese because she's an almana. And as we know, and on the other hand, against that, you have the esse of yibum. Fine, ve'ein esse doicha lois hese ve'esse, and we know that an esse cannot override a lois hese and an esse. So therefore, that would make it that. So sure, it becomes easy enough to understand why he wouldn't be doing yibum in that case. But the Mishnah is saying as a generic statement that he can never do Yibum. Well, why? If his brother died when only after Erusin with this woman, why shouldn't the Kohen Gadol be able to do Yibum with her? Yovei Esev Yid Chalois Esev. Why shouldn't we say that the Esev of Yibum overrides the Lois Esev of not marrying an Almana? Which we know that an esse is doicha lois esse, where under certain conditions, the Gemara deals at the beginning of Yevamos extensively with the conditions for it. Among other things, yeah, it has to be only a lois esse, not another esse as well. You have the idea. You have, for example, it has to be that it's impossible to do the esse any other way other than by violating the lois esse. Well, all of those criteria seem to be met over here, so why not? And the answer is gzeira b'rishona oto b'yashnia. You're right. Minatora, he might indeed be able to, but we make a gzeira because then he might have relations with her a second time, and he might confuse it with the first one. He might think once the first time was allowed, then the second one is also. Well, the second and any subsequent times that he has relations with her, he's not accomplishing the mitzvah because the mitzvah has already been done, and he's over on the lois hese because as long as he stays married to an almana, every time he has relations with her, he's over on the lois hese. In other words, the fact that she's his brother's wife and she's an erva to him, fine. Yibum takes that iser away completely. In effect, there's no iser of that left. But the almana l'kohen gadol, we're only saying is because it's allowed because esed doicha lois esed, and over here you're not going to have that. Or you will have that the first time, but you wouldn't have that later on. Tani nami hochi, we learn similarly in a braisa, which says im kodmu ubalu, if the various cases that are described in Masechta Yevamos, a number of cases over there where it's also midrabanan for them to do yibum. Or actually, not so much midrabanan. Well, where it's also because of an isur lois hese, so they're not supposed to do it. Other examples would be, for example, let's say the wife was a mamzeres, where the brother was also to be married to her as well, and now the new brother, if he marries her, is also over on a lois hese. So in all those cases, they're not supposed to. But the braisa says in kodmu v'alu b'rishona, the fact is, if they do go and do the first bi'ila konu, then they have acquired the yavama. Also the kaiman b'viyashnia. However, you're not allowed to keep them. for the second via and onward. He does have to divorce them after that. So the same way, the Kohen Gadol would be the situation of the Kohen Gadol over here. Next, the Mishnah had said, Mesle Meschula, the Mishnah had described that if a Kohen Gadol's relative dies, so now to attend the Levaya he certainly can't do because he's not allowed to become Tomei Mes. And if he goes to the Levaya, there's a very good chance that he's going to be. So what does he do? Reb Meir had said in the Mishnah that he has to follow them at a distance. When they turn a corner, then he's allowed. When they turn a corner to go off a certain street, then he's allowed to enter that street. So he always has to stay like a block or two or whatever behind. As opposed to Rabbi Yehuda, until they get to the gate of the city. Rabbi Yehuda had said that he can't leave the Beis Hamikdash at all. Tana Rabbanan, the Braisa expands on it. When the Pasuk says, "Umin Mikdash lo yetze," when it says he should not go out of the Mikdash, so the mayor doesn't understand that to mean literally that he can't go out of the Beis Mikdash. He just understands that it means that he has to remain in his state of Kedusha. So, lo yetze imohen, it means he can't go out with them. Avo yotze hu acharehen, however, he could go out after them. Ketzad, hey nixin, v'hu nigla, hey niglin, v'hu nixa. So when they're concealed from view, then he's allowed to reveal himself. So in other words, let's say, they've turned the corner. They were walking along a certain street, and anybody who's walking along that street would see them. Now they've turned the corner, and they're out of view of the people on that street. Now at that point, the Kohen Gadol is allowed to be nigla. Now he can reveal himself to the people on that street and start walking down it. So basically, he's walking behind them at a distance, but enough of a distance that he and they are never visible at the same time. And then when they're revealed, when they're visible on a particular street or on a particular block, then he needs to be covered, he needs to be out of sight at that time. So the point is, he's going far enough behind that there's no possibility that he's going to touch the Oren. So that's where a mayor gets his din from. Now, the mayor had continued the Yotzad Pesachola, that he goes out until the gate of the city, and then he has to stop there. Mefoshim point out an interesting point, because once you go past the gate of the city, there are no buildings anymore. So then you don't have how you're going to have this nigla and nixa. Everybody's going to be visible at the same time, and you're supposed to avoid that. Anyway, so Rabbi Yehuda says in the Mishnah that no, the Pasuk says, Mino Mikdash lo yetze, he should not go out of the Mikdash. Therefore, he's not allowed to go out of the Beis Mikdash. Well, so he can't go to the Levaya at all. Well, the Gemara says, Shapir Ka'omale Rabbi Yehuda. Doesn't Rabbi Yehuda have a good point? How is Rabbi Meir understanding that Pasuk? The answer is, Amalach Rabbi Meir, Yehokhi Levesi Namiloi. By that logic, the Kohen Gadol wouldn't be able to go home either. Ela hachikama, obviously the pasuk means, it means he shouldn't abandon his kedusha. So in other words, he has to make extra effort to preserve his kedusha and not to actually touch the mitta when he's going to Levaya. So therefore, so Rav Meir says, listen, v'chivin de'islai hekera, given that he has a proper heker, he's going to be able, he's doing it in such a way where he's going so far behind everybody else that itself gives him a heker that he's not supposed to come close enough. So therefore, finally, osi l'minga, he won't come to touch, and therefore that's good enough. It doesn't literally mean, omen ha-mikdash l'yetza, he can't leave the Beis HaMikdash. V'Rabbi Yehuda, what does Rabbi Yehuda answer to that? He says, fine, but on the other hand, Agav Merori, Dilma Mikri, V'Ossi V'Noga. On the other hand, because he's so bitter, because he's in such deep mourning over his relative, he might still accidentally touch, even if we do make him stay far behind. So therefore, we're going to make a Gzera on top of that and say that he can't leave the Beis HaMikdash at all. There is some interesting discussion about that. So then, does it mean that midaraisa he's not allowed to, or does it mean that midaraisa he's not allowed to, and the Torah itself is giving this siyug to that he shouldn't even leave the Beis HaMikdash in order not to come to touch. Or does it mean that it's midrabanan that midaraisa? Yes, he would be able to leave, but midrabanan he's not supposed to. The halacha is like Rabbi Yehuda in that, so he doesn't go out of the Beis Hamikdash, he doesn't go to the Levaya at all. B'chlal, the Rambam writes that the Kohen Gadol is not even allowed to leave Yerushalayim, except when there's matters of a pikuach nefesh, like Shimon HaTzadik and Amin Alexander the Great. But other than that, he's not supposed to leave Yerushalayim. To leave the Beis Hamikdash, he can, to go home, but not to. Next, the Mishnah continued, Kshu Menachem, the Mishnah continued that when he's going to be Menachem other people whose relatives have passed away. So the Mishnah had described that you have like this. You have, usually you'll have a shura, you'll have a row of avelim standing over there, and then you have the regular people who are going to be standing there in rows surrounding them, and the avelim are going to walk between them, and people are going to say to them, Amokam Menachem Eschem. In this case, because the Kohen Gadol is involved, so we said the Mamuna stands between him and the rest of the people. So we'll discuss now what this Mamuna means. Mamuna literally means the appointed official. When he's walking in the shura in the line over there to be Menachem others. Sgan umashuach sh'ovar. So you have the Sgan, which is the deputy Kohen Gadol, umashuach sh'ovar. You have a Kohen Gadol who was anointed. You may have a Kohen Gadol who was anointed with Shemen HaMishcha and now is out of the job. Namely, you can have that a Kohen Gadol at one point was a Balmum or Tomei or what have you. So they had to appoint a new Kohen Gadol instead of him. And back when they had the Shemen HaMishcha, up until near the end of the first Beis Hamikdash, they would anoint this new one with the Shemen HaMishcha as well. Eventually, the original Kohen Gadol recovers or becomes Tahor and resumes his job. Now, this temporary Kohen Gadol is called Mashuach She'ovar. Biminoi, such people would walk on the Kohen Gadol's right side. As a mark of distinction, the Sgan, he's the deputy Kohen Gadol. He's basically like Lahavdil, like the vice president to the president, his right hand, literally his right hand man. So therefore, he walks on the Kohen Gadol's right. And the Mashuach She'ovar is also a person of great dignity. He held the position of Kohen Gadol for a period of time after all. So therefore, he would also walk on the right. The Rosh base of, then the head of the base of, as we know, the Kohen God, the Kohenim, were split up into 24 Mishmaras. Each Mishmar would serve in the Beis Hamikdash for 1 week, and each Mishmar in turn was divided up into Bote Avos, where each one would serve a different day of the week. So the head of the base of that day, the Avelim, and all the Avelim, Mokhala'am, and the rest of the people, Mishmoylo, are on the Kohen God's left side. So that's when the Kohen Gadol is a member of the public who's going to be Menachem of all the Avelim. So the point is, we're saying that he doesn't just walk in the Shura like everybody else. He's flanked by important people on both sides. Now, when the Kohen Gadol himself is one of the Avelim, and he's one of the ones standing in the Shura, in the row of Avelim, then similarly, Sgan Mimini, the Rosh Beis of, then Sgan stands as his right, and the Rosh Beis of, and everybody else stands on his left. Now, unlike in the previous case, where he's going to be Menachem Oval, where we're saying that also, if there's a Mashuach She'ovar, he participates as well, here, that's not mentioned. So the Gemara points out, when the Kohen Gadol is in Avelus, Then, even if there is at the time a Mashuach She'ovar, he does not come and join the procession for to be Menachem Oval him, or at least if he does, he stands among the regular people rather than flanking the Kohen Gadol like before. My timer, why? Because Chol Shadaite. Because then at a time like that, the Kohen Gadol may feel bad. He's going to think, you know what? Maybe this guy is happy in my misfortune. After all, you know, if I hadn't recovered from being Tomei, or if I had remained Tomei, or if I'd remained a Balmum, or whatever, this guy would now be serving as Kohen Gadol, and now kind of like I took back over my job and pushed him out, so the Kohen Gadol may think that maybe he's happy, that maybe the reason why he's coming over here is because he's happy to see that I'm in mourning. So therefore, better that the Mashuach She'ovar shouldn't even be present at all at a time like that. So the Gemara points out, by the way, says Rav Papa, you can learn three dinim about the way that Nichum Avelim works, or the way that the Shura works. You can learn three things from the description in our Mishnah, or from this Braisa, rather. First of all, we see that the Mamuna of our Mishnah is identical with the Sgan, because the Mishnah had said that Hamamuna, that the Mamuna, Mematze Beina Levena Am, he stands in between him, he stands or walks between the Kohen Gadol and the people, and here in the Braisa, in the Mishnah, it said Mamuna, the appointed official. And here in the Braisa, instead it mentions the Sgan in that connection. So we see that the Sgan is the Mamuna. Tosfos points out, you're not going to say it's the Mashuach She'ovar for two reasons. First of all, there's no reason to call Mashuach She'ovar Mamuna. Mamuna implies somebody who's appointed to an ongoing thing, whereas this guy was a one-time thing. Also, Tosfos says that that we said in the Mishnah that in both cases, the Mishnah implies that in both cases, whether the Kohen Gadol is being Menachem others, or whether he's the one being, whether he's the one whom others are Menachem, because he's in Avelos, the Mishnah seems to imply that either way, the Mamuna is there, and again, we said the Mashuach She'ovar is not going to be there when the Kohen Gadol himself is an Ovel. Okay, so that's the first thing we can learn. The second thing we can learn is when it comes to the Shura, the Avelim stand in place and the people are the ones who pass by in order to be Menachem Avol him, because that's the Braisa is saying that he's true over Bashura when he's walking in the Shura, meaning in other words that he's walking to be Menachem others. Nowadays, many minhagim of Avelos have changed somewhat since the times of the Gemara. Nowadays, I think we often have it the other way around, that after the Levaya, the Avelim will walk between the rows of standing people and they'll say, Hamakim Menachem Eschem. But in the times of the Gemara, it comes out that it was the other way around. The Avelim would stand in place and the people would walk by them. I guess a vestige of that we have in the Shiva house where the Oval sits and everybody files by and says, Hamokim Menachem Eschem. Okay. So that's the second thing. And the third thing was Shmamina Avelim L'smol Amenachem Hem Oindim. And we see the third thing is we see that the Avelim stand to the left of those who are saying Nichum over them. As we see over here, that the Avelim are standing to the left of the Kohen Gadol when he's coming to be Menachem then. That's according to Rashi. Tosfos explains a little differently the fact that we're saying that the Mishnah had said that the Mamuna, which again we said is the Sgan, stands between him and the people, and the Braisa says that the Rosh Beis Av and everybody else stands on his left side together with the rest of the people. So we see that the people are on his left side. So, or rather, we see that people first start on his right side, and then they're on the left. And so we see, in other words, that they're to the left of the oval. So the Seder is the people first come to his left, then the Avelim, and therefore now after that, so now the Avelim are to the left of everybody else. Okay. Next. Gemara continues. Originally, it used to be like that, that the Avelim would stand in one place and everybody else would pass by and be Menachem then. But what happened was two prominent families in Yerushalayim got into an argument about it. Each one was claiming the right to go first to be Menachem the Avelim. So they made the takana, the people should stand in their place and the Avelim should walk through, and that way there's no friction like that, because now the common people are not, the regular people, the non-Avelim, are not walking at all, they're staying in place, and that way there's not going to be any friction between people who are, between who's going to get to walk first. So the Gemara says, Chozo v'holach umei for simen, v'sipur simen. This is a simen for three key words from the Braisa. Is going to, the Rami Ba'aba is going to continue about three takonis of Rabbi Shmuel, of Rabbi Yossi, which are hinted at by these three words. So Omar Rami Ba'aba hechse Rabbi Yossi as a davar l'yoshne b'tzipori. Rabbi Yossi, who was the Rav in Tzipori, who lived in Tzipori, and he was the Rav there, he made the takona to put things back to the way it was. And supposedly, shiu avelim omdin v'cholam omdin, that the avelim will stand still and everybody else will pass by. Apparently, in Sapodi, you didn't have the social issue between the families that are arguing over there, and therefore, Rabbi Yossi said it really would be better to go back to the old way. The only reason they changed it in Yerushalayim is because of this friction between the two families. Here in Sapodi, we don't have that, and therefore he went back to the way it was before. Mephoshim explained that actually it wasn't necessarily just in Sephardi. Once he returned things to the way it was, then really it should be that way everywhere. Again, with that said, though, apparently over time the minhag has changed anyway, and nowadays typically the Avelim walk through. V'omer Rami Ba'aba, so since we're mentioning a takana that Rabbi Yossi made in Sephardi, so Rami Ba'aba mentions two other ones. V'omer Rami Ba'aba, hiskin Rabbi Yossi b'tzipori, sh'loi tehi isha mahalachas b'shuk uvna achareha. Rabbi Yossi made a takana in Sephardi, and again, it's not just for Sephardi. He was the Rav in Sephardi, so that's where he could make the takanas, but in fact, it applies everywhere else as well, that a woman should not walk in the street with her little child behind her. The child should walk in front of her. And the reason is Mishum Maisa Shahaya, because of a thing that actually once happened. Namely, one time the kid was walking behind her, some mean people grabbed the child, pretending to kidnap him as a joke. Whatever, as we'll see, it wasn't a joke, but whatever. The point is they kidnapped him and put him in a house. Then she hears her son crying. She's going to find what happened, and one of them comes and tells her, "Come, I'll show him to you." And she goes into the house and they raped her over there. So in the future, she should walk with the child in front, and that way she can keep an eye on him, and that way nobody can grab him without her seeing. V'omer Rami Ba'aba, and a third thing Rami Ba'aba says, Hiskin Rabbi Yossi b'tzipori, shiu noshim misapris zuim zu b'veis akise. That that women should talk with one another in the bathroom. You have to remember, back then the bathrooms were out in the fields, and everybody would go there. And the reason is mishum yichud, because of yichud, because when a woman is there, a man might come in, and there might be yichud over there. One man and one woman is yichud. So when there are two women over there and they're talking with one another, men are going to hear their voices, and they're going to know not to come in, and therefore that'll avoid issues of yichud. There is quite a bit of discussion. In other words, Rashi explains that the vote is that the person might be over on the issue of yichud. So like this, in other words, if there are two women, the point is, even if there are two women there, the Gemara tells us at the end of Kiddushin, when it discusses all the dinim of Yichud, that one man is not even allowed to be alone with two women either, unless there's certain cases where the two women naturally dislike one another, like a mother-in-law and daughter-in-law. There are some other examples over there, but ordinarily, a man is not allowed to be in Yichud even with two women. But the point is, when he hears them talking, then he's going to know not to come in. In fact, there is some interesting discussion about that. The Nitziv points out in Merei Masada, in that case, if it's only a problem of Yichud, then one woman over there should talk also, so a man doesn't come in there. So he explains a little differently, that the concern is about Anoshim Prutzim, that you have Pritzistik of people who are not so tzniistik. So when it's one woman, even if he hears her voice, it's not going to dissuade him from coming in. But when there's two, then already, even though in principle there could be yichud then and there could be aveira then, but it's less likely. In fact, the Yad Ramah discusses over here is the iser because of only yichud, or is in fact because they might actually commit znus, and he discusses the two possibilities over here. There is a bichlal. On the other hand, ordinarily we say in the Gemara you're not supposed to talk in the bathroom. It's not sneistic too, but this is an exception. And there is a little bit of discussion about again what the purpose behind it is. And what the purpose behind it is, and how the talking accomplishes that. One thing is that the Rishonim say, and the Ramah brings it, that Yeshomim, that this is only a problem in those days when bathrooms are out in the fields. Nowadays, that it's in the city, then we're not concerned, and women don't have to talk in the bathroom. So those were three. The reason we brought that in again is because there were three takanas that Rabbi Yossi made in Sephardi. The first one of them having directly to do with our Mishnah about where the Avelim are versus where the people are. Okay. Getting back to the matters of Avelos, Omer of Menashe about Us, She'elus es Rabbi Yoshia Rabbah. I asked Rabbi Yoshia the Great, Beveis Alman de Hutzel, in the base Olamim, meaning the base Akvaris of the city of Hutzel. Rabbi Yoshia Rabbah is because there was a later Rabbi Yoshia, so this is Rabbi Yoshia the Great, meaning the elder. Anyway, so Rabbi Menashe about Us says, I asked him in that base Akvaris, how do we do it? And he tells me, the shura, these lines of people who are standing or walking over there according to the different times, and the avail and being menachem the avelim, that shura has to be at least 10 people. The ain avelim in a minyan, and the avelim don't count towards the 10. So you have to have 10 people plus the avelim. Obviously, when he asked him in the Beis HaKvaros over there, it was very likely that there was an actual case going on over there. There was an actual levaya going on, and therefore we needed to know how to arrange it, or that there was soon going to be a levaya, whatever. And also, he told me, and this applies, Bein Sha'avelim Omdin V'chol Om Oivrin, Bein Sha'avelim Oivrin V'chol Om Oivrin. That applies whether we do like the way it used to be, and like the way Rabbi Yossi made it afterwards in Sipodi, that the Avelim stand in one place and everybody else passes by, files by them. Ben Sha'avelim Omdin V'chol Om Omdin, or whether the Avelim are walking along and the people are standing still. Either way, you have to have 10 people besides them. This is one of the sources where you have to have 10 people for a Levaya. Now, the Mishnah said, that when the Kohen Gadol is an oval and people are coming to be Menachem him, so everybody tells him, Onu kaparoscha, they say to him, we are your kapara. In other words, whatever misfortunes should happen to you, we're willing to take on ourselves. Rashi says, in the Mishnah, we're willing to stand in your place for anything that would happen to you. So in other words, they're saying, basically, now it happened to you, but in the future, if there's anything that should happen to you, we're willing to take it on ourselves. So the Gemara says, what about what's the other way around? When the Kohen Gadol comes to be Menachem others, what nusach does he say to them? So the Gemara says, Toshma, well, we learn in a Braisa. Vuhu Omer, Tisnachmu. He says to them, may you be comforted. Now, when would he be saying that? Heichidomi, when would he be saying such a loshen? Ilema ki menachmi achrini l'didei. Do you mean when other people are being menachem him? What it mean, in other words, that when he is sitting, that when he's not sitting shiva, when there are others who are sitting shiva, and he comes to be menachem them, and then they tell and that you're going to say that, or no, the other way around, you're going to say that when people are coming to be menachem ovel him, and they say onu kaparoscha, he would say to them tisnachmu, may you be comforted. How could that be? Why would he be telling them, may you be comforted? Is he basically like casting almost a spell on them, saying there's going to come a time when you're going to need nichum as well? You don't talk like that. You don't say tisnachmu as if like, yes, there's going to come a time in the future when you're going to need comfort. So it can't mean that. Ella. So no, it means that when he's menachem others, what he says to them is tisnachmu, may you be comforted. Shmamina. So therefore, that answers that. The Yad Ramah brings a different girsa over here. That the loshen of the braisa is everybody tells him onu kaparoscha, and he tells them tisnachmu mina shemayim, that may you be comforted from shemayim. And then the Gemara is saying that no, there's two different things. There's shahu, everybody tells him onu kaparoscha when he's sitting shiva. On the other hand, when he's going and being menachem others, then he says to them tisnachmu mina shemayim, may you be comforted from shemayim, which is similar to our nusach that we say amok menachem eschem. Okay, so that deals with matters of the Kohen Gadol so far. Now, the Mishnah had started then with certain things, certain dinim about the king, some of which are a contrast with those of the Kohen Gadol. So one of the things the Mishnah had said is HaMelech Lo Don Chula. A king cannot judge, he cannot sit on a Beis Din, and they can't judge him, and he doesn't give Eidos, and others don't, and others don't give Eidos about him. So the Gemara says, Amar Rabbi Yosef, lo shonu ela malchei Yisrael. This that we're saying, that a king cannot be judged by Beis Din, is only talking about malchei Yisrael, kings from the other Shvatim. Aval Malchut Beis David Don V'Don in Oisan. But kings from Beis David, they can judge. They can indeed sit on a Beis Din, and they can be judged by Beis Din. The Gemara had explained at the beginning of the Perek that if a person is going to be able to be, is going to be, in order, the two things are reciprocal. We have the expression, fix up others, then fix up yourselves. So fix up yourself. So only if a person is able to be judged by Beis Din, only then is he suitable to sit on a Beis Din. So therefore, so since, as the Gemara is going to bring over here from a Pasuk, a king from Malchut Beis David is able to sit on a Beis Din, then necessarily it means that he has to be able to be judged by Beis Din as well. So how do we know that they sit on a Beis Din? Dichtiv, as the pasuk says, Beis David. The Navi Yirmiyah says to the house of David, to the king of his times, which is Yehoyakim, Dinu laboka mishpat. Judge justice in the morning. So we see, in other words, that the king, now there is a concept of din malchus. There is a concept that the king is supposed to judge people in cases where the Sanhedrin can't deal with it. You have various cases, as we're going to learn, throughout the Masechta. You have cases where the Sanhedrin can't judge a person because there's insufficient eidos, so there wasn't proper hasra, etc. So a king is able to judge such cases extra legally. However, the Gemara's understanding over here that the pasuk is also implying that the king has a responsibility to judge as a member of the Sanhedrin as well. So he has to be able to sit on the Sanhedrin. The pasuk clearly says so, and you're not going to say that. In other words, that the chachamim are not going to make a takana against that. There is a concept that's brought that when the pasuk says clearly that you're supposed to do something, then the Chachamim don't have the ability to override that. So the Chachamim are not going to override that. So a king of Beis David can sit on a Beis Din, and therefore he can also be judged. So the Eloi Dainin Olai, if we're not allowed to judge him, Inu Hechi Daini, then how would the king himself be able to judge? V'oksiv, Hiskoshishu V'koshu, as it said at the beginning of the parak, the Pasuk says, Hiskoshishu V'koshu, where literally it means like gather yourselves together and gather together. V'omer Rishlokish, and Rishlokish says that it means beautify yourself and then beautify others. In other words, you can't have a person who's immune to being judged by Beis Din, but he himself can sit on a Beis Din. So therefore, if the king can sit on a Beis Din, means that he has to be able to be judged by Beis Din as well. So Malchut Beis David are in fact allowed to sit on a Sanhedrin. Tosfos points out over here that the Gemara before had said that the king is not supposed to sit on the Sanhedrin because the Pasuk says, Lo sana al riv. And one of the drushes that we learn from that is loisana al rav. You're not allowed to contradict the words of the rav of the great person. So in other words, if the king is sitting over there in Beis Din, nobody would disagree with him, and that's not how a Beis Din works, because a Beis Din has to have that people are going to argue with each other. For that reason, in fact, we have when it comes to dini nefoshes, we have for that reason that as we're going to learn later on in the Masechta, the deliberations start with the junior members of Beis Din, and then they work their way up to the senior ones. So over here, if the king is a member of the Beis Din, then you're going to have a problem whenever he speaks up, nobody should be contradicting him. So the point is, the Gemara had said before that a king can't sit on the Sanhedrin. How are we saying over here, Melech Don? So Tosfos says that there's a difference between dinim mominus and dinim nefashis, because by dinim mominus there's no problem contradicting the greater one. In fact, by dinim mominus, as we're going to learn later in the Masechta, the Rosh Beis Din does speak first, so by the same token, the king can speak, and they would be allowed to contradict him. Then Tosfos says also another point, by dinim nefashis, if it's a matter of morid b'malchus, then the king is allowed to sit on such a Beis Din, because since it's an issue of morid b'malchus, somebody is being accused of rebelling and being disrespectful to the king. Since it's a matter of the king's own covered, then therefore the king won't mind if other people speak up against him, and therefore the king can sit on such a Beis Din. But when it comes to other matters, then no, a king can't sit. And we're saying a king can sit on a Beis Din, but only as far as dinim mominus, Tosfos is saying. Actually, the Chazon Ish brings an interesting idea. The point would be that you have, we've learned about in the first Perek, you have the Muflash of a Beis Din. You have the most distinguished member of the Beis Din. Generally, he would be the Av Beis Din. You're not allowed to argue with him because he's the greatest member, which is why when Dinin Nefashos, he would speak up last. On the other hand, so even the king shouldn't be arguing with the Mufla. Well, the Mufla shouldn't be arguing with the king either out of respect for the king. Well, what happens if the king and the Mufla are the same person? For example, David HaMelech was one of the greatest Talmid Chacham of his times, and he was able to serve as a mufla of a Beis Din. Well, then there's no problem. He's not arguing against himself, so therefore it would be perfectly allowed for him to sit on a Beis Din. Okay, so that's Malchi Beis David. Ela Malchi Yisrael, my time aloy. So why shouldn't Malchi Yisrael, why shouldn't kings from other Shvatim sit on a Beis Din? Mishum Maisa Shahoya. The reason is because of an actual case that happened where it caused a tragedy. What happened was the Avde de Yanei Malka Kotel Nafsha. Yanei Amelach's slave one time killed a person. Now there was an actual king, one of the later Chashmonoim, who was called Yanei HaMelech. However, sometimes it seems that the Gemara uses Yanei HaMelech as a generic term, meaning any of the kings from this dynasty. In this case, we'll talk about soon that there is a very similar case, very similar to the story in our Gemara that happened in a generation or two after Yanei. Anyway, so that his slave killed a person. So Shimon ben Shatach says to the Chachamim, "Tshnu einechem boy undenenu. Put your eyes on him." In other words, don't let him get away with it. Put your eyes on him, but focus on him undenenu, and we're going to judge him. We're going to judge this Eved for having killed. Shochulei. So they sent to Yana a message. Avdecha katol nafsha. Your slave has killed somebody. We got to bring him to Beis Din. Shadri lahu. So he sends his Eved to be tried in front of Beis Din. They sent a message to Yanai, Ta ant nami lahocha. You also come over here, because after all, the Pasuk says, Vahuad biv olav, the Pasuk says about a shur that kills, Vahuad biv olav, the owner is wound, from which we learn, Yove bala shur v'yamed al shurai. The owner of the shur has to come and be present when his shur is being tried and sentenced. And in the same way over here, you being the owner of this eved, you have to be over here. Marsha points out that in that case, Yanai could get out of that. He could free the guy, and then he's not an eved anymore. But he didn't really want to. He liked this eved. He didn't want to have him executed. As we're going to say, he tried to overawe the Beis Din with it by coming over there in full majesty, and then So first he figured he's a slave of the king. They're going to be afraid to judge him lemissa. But then they're telling him, you have to be present. So now he's going to try to basically blackmail the Beis Din. Now Marsha mentions in this connection that this Eved, based on Sefer Yosifun, on an adaptation from Josephus's history, that this Eved was none other than Hurdus. So actually, the way Josephus tells the story in detail over there is Hurdus at one point is the governor of an area in Eretz Yisrael. So yeah, you still have the later Chashmonoim are still alive. Officially, he answers to Hyrcanus, who was one of the later Chashmonoim. And then it wasn't just that he killed one person. He supposedly put down an uprising over there in the Galil, which involved killing a lot of Jews. And now he's going to be on trial in front of the Sanhedrin. So in that case, if it is the same story, then the king over here is not actually Yanai, but rather Yanai's son Hyrcanus. And the slave is Hordus. Anyway, so the Beis Din is telling Yanai, or whichever king it was, you have to come be present over here when your Eved is being tried. Osav Yosef. So Yanai came and he sat down. Omele, Shimon ben Shotach. Shimon ben Shotach says to him, you can't be sitting down. Yanai Amelach, Amoida Raglecha v'yidu b'cha. Yanai Amelach, stand on your feet and let us testify against you. You have to be standing when the Edris is given. V'loyla fonenu ata oimed. In fact, you should know, you're not just standing in front of us out of respect for the Beis Din. Elolof mimisha omo v'hoya oilam ata oimed. You're standing in front of the one who spoke and the world came into existence, in front of Hashem. The pasuk says the two men who are having the argument should stand in front of Hashem. So you need to be standing as one of the Baalei Din. Tosfos points out that in principle, the Gemara tells us in Shavuos, we'll get to it later this year, Be'ez Hashem, that they could have them both sit. So it's not actually, it's only usur if the two parties to the Din Torah are one standing and one sitting. So in that case, then, so why does Shimon and Shaddai have to tell Yana to stand? Let him tell the other guy to sit. So first, Tosafot says maybe Dinin Nefashos is different, or maybe when it comes to hearing the Eidos, then that's different. Maybe they do have to be standing when the Eidim are testifying. And Tosafot says a practical halacha that comes from that is maybe in fact the Bali Dinim should be sitting when the Eidos is being given. In practice, actually, the Rambam writes that later on in later times it became difficult to enforce this kind of thing, and therefore very often people do sit in front of the Beis Din, but at least in this times they still had that. There is actually a lot of further discussion about that. The fact is, the Gemara also tells us in Shavuos that a Talmid Chacham doesn't have to stand in Beis Din in the first place. We allow him to sit because of the Kavod HaTorah, and the Kavod of a king is greater than the Kavod of a Talmid Chacham. So the Ran brings up the point then, following up on what Tosfos says, why shouldn't they allow Yanai to sit? So the Ran gives an answer in the name of Rabbeinu David. But the difference is that the point is that honor for the Beis Din is covered for the Torah. Honor for the Talmid Chacham is also covered for the Torah. So therefore, Talmid Chacham doesn't need to stand, but a king's covered has nothing to do with the Torah. It's a separate thing. So therefore, he should have to stand. And then there are other explanations as well. Rabbeinu Yonah and the Ran brings this as a possibility as well, is that Yanai sat down even before Beis Din gave him permission to, and he can't do that. At least he has to wait until Beis Din tells him to sit down. The Ran actually brings a third possibility, that Shimon and Shaddai actually made a mistake, which in that case, I don't even know, Beis Din made a mistake. So it's hard to say that, but on the other hand, the fact is, even if he made a mistake, the halacha is still that way. You still don't contradict him in the matter of the halacha, and therefore, as the Gemara is going to go on to say, the members of the Beis Din were punished for not enforcing the halacha as Shimon ben Shaddach understood it. Anyway. So Shimon ben Shaddach is telling him to stand up. Bichlal, by the way, an interesting point is how Shimon ben Shaddach is able to judge Yanai when we know Shimon ben Shaddach was married to Yanai's sister, Shloimzion. So if you say it's not Yanai, but rather one of the later kings, then maybe it's not so bad, because in that case, if it was Hyrcanus, then he's actually Shimon ben Shaddach's nephew. Maybe that's not so much of an issue, although it is later on in the next perek, when we learn about the dinim of who's posel le'edus and who's posel to judge, then an uncle and a nephew are included as well. So if it was a great nephew, maybe it wouldn't be such an issue, whatever. But there are various other possibilities. Some mafreshim say that no, this was actually earlier. It was before Shimon ben Shaddach married Shloimzion. And another possibility is maybe Shimon ben Shaddach is not actually one of the sitting members of the Sanhedrin. He's just there in order to encourage them to do the right thing. Anyway, Omar Loi, so Yanai says, Loik Shatoimer Ata, never mind what you're saying. I don't have to follow you, just you. El Kamashi Yemer Chavirecha. What do your colleagues have to say? What are the rest of the members of the Beis Din have to say? Are they going to require me to stand as well? Nifne liyaminoi, so Shimon Shaddach looks to his right to see if the dayanim, he's sitting in the middle, so he looks to his right to see if the other dayanim are going to say anything. Kovshu pnei b'karka, and they hid their face in the ground, like they didn't want to, they were afraid of Yanai, and they didn't want to speak up and tell him to his face that you have to stand. Nifne l'smoyle kovshu pnei b'karka, and also kovshu pnei b'karka, and Shimon Shaddach looks to his left, and also everybody's hiding their face on the ground and not speaking. Omalahan Shimon Shaddach. So Shimon Shaddach says to them, "Bale machshavas atem. I see that you're masters of thoughts. In other words, you're thinking too deeply into this. You're afraid of the. You're afraid of it. You're making yourselves as though you're thinking other kinds of things. When a person is thinking, he usually puts his head down to think. So you're pretending as though you're thinking into it. What should we say? But I know the truth that you're doing it because you're afraid of Yanai. Yovei bal machshavas v'paramikem. So he says the master of thoughts, Hashem, who knows everyone's thoughts, should come and punish you that you're chanfening Yanai, and you're not speaking up to tell him what he has to do out of fear or out of respect. Or whatever from him. Miyad bo Gavriel v'chovten v'karko umesu. Right away, Malach Gavriel came and banged them on the ground, and they died. So a tragedy happened because they were trying to judge a Melech Yisrael. But Oisa Shal Amru. So at that point, the Chacham made the takana. Melech loy don in Oisa. They made loy me'id in Oisa. Now, a melech of Malchi Yisrael, which includes Yanai, who was from a different sheva, then he's not judged. He doesn't sit on a base din or judge. He doesn't give eidos, and eidos is not set against him. And that way it prevents such a tragedy from happening again. But on the other hand, with Malchi Beis David, we're not concerned about that, because after all, the Pasuk does tell him to judge, and therefore with Malchi Beis David, it continues to be. The Rambam, when he brings this halacha in Hilchos Malachim, formulates it a little differently. He says the expression that the Malchi Yisrael are libun gas behem, they're very proud, they're very proud, self-assured people, and therefore, if they come in front of Beis Din, then there's going to be hefted lados. It's going to cause a damage to the Jewish religion. In other words, that people are going to see that a person can be a chutzpah nyak in front of Beis Din. So he apparently understands the story that way over here, that the problem is people are going to learn from Yanai that it's okay to be a mechutzef in front of Beis Din, and that he might even get away with it, as we see that apparently he did over here. Agav, when Josephus tells the story, he actually, so he identifies the central figure over here. He instead of Shimon Shaddach in the Gemara over here, he calls him Samias in Greek. Historians argue whether it is in fact Shimon Shaddach, or whether maybe it's Shmaya of Avtalion, or maybe even it's Shammai of Hillel and Shammai. He goes on to say that later on, when Hudus became king, he revenged himself on most of the Chachamim, as we know from the Gemara in Bava Basra, that he killed many of the Chachamim of his generation, but he spared the Samias, whether it means Shmaya or Shammai or whoever, out of respect for him, because he had a shtickle derech eretz that the guy that whoever it was, that this chacham had the guts to stand up to him in a case like this. Next, the Mishnah had said about a king, like chulitz v'lechulitz in chula, the Mishnah had said that a king does not do chalitza, because it would be a bizoyin to him that his yavama should spit on the ground in front of him. But the Mishnah had said also that chalitza is not done for his wife, because Rashi says, look, she's also to marry anyhow, she's also to remarry anyhow, as the Mishnah is going to go on to say. So therefore, once she was the king's wife, she's also to anybody else. So there's no point in doing chalitza. No point in doing chalitza. He can't do yibum, and you can't do yibum with his wife. Rabbi Yehuda says, on the other hand, if he wants to do chalitza or yibum, then zochor latoiv. If he's willing to set aside his covenant and do chalitza, or he's willing to set aside his covenant and do yibum, then fine. Rabbi Yehuda says gizunta heit, and he should be remembered for good. So the Gemara asks, Eini, is that so? How could Rabbi Yehuda say such a thing? Va'omar Rav Ashi, didn't Rav Ashi say, afilu l'manda omar melech nosi shemochol kvodi kvodi mochol, even according to the opinion in a Gemara in Kiddushin, that a nosi is able to forgive his covered, and it is valid, and therefore he's able to do that. He's able to forego his honor. But everybody agrees, melech shemochol kvodi in kvodi mochol, that if a king foregoes his honor, it doesn't work. Shenemar, because the Pasuk says, son tos melech melech, place, you should place upon yourself a king, which means that there should be fear of the king on you, and therefore, so his covered, the Rambam explains it, his covered is not his own, it's the covered of the whole Jewish people, so he's not able to forego it. So Rashi elsewhere explains that we actually had an Ein Yaakov before Hanukkah, that the point is Sim Tosim means they have to do over and over, they have to place the king on him, which means, in other words, basically, so if he's Moichel is covered, as it, the Hamakne explains, it's as if like he's making himself not king, and they have a mitzvah to remake him a king and to still have covered for him and not allow him to override his covered. So in any case, the point is the point is the king is not able to forego his covered. So how can Rabbi Yehuda say that he could do that in order to do chalitza or yibum? And the answer is mitzvah shiny. It's different when he's doing a mitzvah. Rabbi Yehuda figures that he can be mochel on his covered in order to do a mitzvah. Whereas the Chachamim disagree and say that even then he shouldn't do it. Next, the Mishnah had said ve'ein noisin chola, that Tosfos points out that there are other places in Shas where the Gemara also deals with how a king was able to forego his honor. Sometimes the Gemara uses that answer mitzvah shiny. Other times the Gemara said, for example, where it says Agrippa Samalach stood up to receive the Sefer Torah by Hakel. So fine, you could say out of covered for the Sefer Torah, he's allowed to do that. On the other hand, you have a case also involving Agrippas in that Gemara in Ksubas, where where there was a kala passing by and he turned off onto a different street in order not to interfere with her procession. And the Gemara doesn't use the answer there. Mitzvah shiny, it says parashas drachim havoy, it was a crossroads and he just pretended as though he needs to take a different road. Because the idea is when the mitzvah is only for the, in the case of hakel, the covered is, in the case of a hakel, the covered is it's covered for the king, and in the case of a yibum, there's also a mitzvah over there. It's not so much a mitzvah. There's a covered of chosin and kala, and the covered of the king overrides the covered of the chosin and kala. But there, when we're talking about the covered of the Torah, or the mitzvah of reading from the Torah, or the mitzvah of yibum, then the Gemara is saying that it could override his covered. Nevertheless, the Chachamim disagree, but Pashtus, because at least they would say, as far as chalitza, at least it involves spitting on the ground in front of him, and such a big bizoyan you can't do. Okay, next, the Mishnah had said, "V'ein noisin chula." The Mishnah had said, you can't marry a king's widow, or divorcee for that matter. And then Rabbi Yehuda had disagreed in the Mishnah and said, one king can marry an almana of a previous king. And he said, because the Pasuk says that after the whole story with Bathsheba, the Navi Nosson comes to criticize David. And he tells him, look, you know, don't think you're deprived of wives that you had to take Bathsheba. Here, Hashem says, Hashem says, I place the wives of your master in your lap. So Rabbi Yehuda takes that to mean, in other words, that there was a woman, there was at least one woman who had been an almana of Shaul, and David married her. So you see that a king is allowed to marry an almana of a previous king. So the Gemara answer is Tanya. So the Gemara says Tanya, Omru loy le Rabbi Yehuda, the Chacham answered Rabbi Yehuda. No, that doesn't mean Shaul's wives. Noshim ra'uyas loy mi beis hamelech. Means that Hashem told David through the Navi that I enabled you to marry women who were suitable for you from the king's family. Umaynin hu meirav o michal. Namely, meirav and michal, the daughters of Shaul, that you were able to marry them. So Hashem is not telling him that you married Shaul's almana. The Chacham hold that would be also. Once she's married to a king, she's not supposed to marry anybody else, even another king. It would be a bizoyan to the first king. But you married their daughters, which is no small thing, since you weren't from the royal family yourself, and therefore you should have been grateful to Hashem for that, and you shouldn't have needed to do this whole thing with Bathsheba. Well, now the question becomes, Merav and Michal are sisters. We know the Torah tells us you're not allowed to marry two sisters. So, sure. Now, the story is like this. In Sefer Shmuel, it tells like this. The Gemara is going to give the summary of it. That when David came to the army camp where they were fighting against the Plishtim, and Goliath is standing over there and hurling insults and saying, nobody can defeat me. So David Shaul had promised that whoever defeats Goliath, among other things, is going to marry the king's daughter. So later on, it says that David was going to marry Merav, and then in the end, he married Michal. The Gemara's understanding, to begin with, that it sounds like he married both Meirav and Michal, that would be a problem. How did David marry two sisters? Well, he's not allowed to marry the second sister while the first one is alive. So once he's married to Meirav, even if he divorced her, he's not allowed to marry Michal. So he tells them Michal, he married Michal only after Meirav died. And that's not a problem. A man is allowed to marry his wife's sister after his wife died. On the other hand, Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha, says that the kiddushin he did with Merav were actually mistaken. They were not valid kiddushin. Well, then he was never married. He had never done proper kiddushin with Merav. Therefore, now he's allowed to marry her younger sister Michal. Because the Pasuk says later on when you have like this. So David again was married to Michal. Now at one point, while David was on the run from Shaul, then the Pasuk says Shaul took Merav and gave her in marriage to somebody named Palti ben Laish. We're going to talk about that further on in the Gemara about the story with that. Anyway, so then later on, when David became king, then he wants Michal back. So he wants Michal back, and he sends a message to Ishbosheth, who at the time was Ishbosheth was the only surviving son of Shaul, and at the time he himself was king in Eivre Yarden over many of the Shvatim. So David sends him a message: I want back my wife Michal, and he says, Asher etnos ishti es Michal, give me back my wife Michal, Asher erat, which is your sister, Asher erasti li mea orlis plishtim, which I betrothed her with 100 orlis of Plishtim. The Psukim describe what happened was at one point before David married Michal, Shaul told him, you have to go kill 100 Plishtim and bring me their Orlis, and then on that condition I'll allow you to marry Michal, as the Gemara is going to tell the story in detail a little further on. So why does he stress Michal Ishti? So the Gemara says, "My Talmud, okay. Where what does the pasuk teach us? Amar Papa, Michal Ishti v'le Meirav Ishti." He's stressing with that. Michal is my wife. Meirav was not. In other words, you Ishbosheth should not start thinking, "Wait a minute, he was married to Meirav before, and Meirav's still alive. And how could you be marrying Michal?" You should know that to begin with, Meirav was never my wife because it turns out the kiddushin I did with her were invalid. And the Rashba actually brings in a truva as well, that David, so why does David have to stress the mayor Orlis Plishtim, is because he's also saying, look, I was Moser Nefesh in order to marry her, so I want you to give her back to me. So the Gemara says, my kedushi tos. So in what way was the kedushin a tos? What happened over here? What was the story over here that David thought he had been Mekadesh Michal, and it turned out that it was incorrect? So dichtiv like this. But when Goliath was standing over there and insulting and saying, "I'm the most mighty one. I want single combat over here, and whoever defeat you Jews are never going to be able to defeat me." And he's even insulting Hashem, etc. Anyway, so the pasuk mentions that that Shaul had given an offer to reward. Whoever kills this guy Goliath, the king is going to give him great wealth. And the pasuk mentions a couple of other things, one of which is he's going to be able to marry the king's daughter. Well, also Katle. So David went, and sure enough, as we know, he killed Goliath. So now he's entitled to the reward. So Omaloi. So now David says to Shaul, now I don't need to give anything else for the kedushin. Milva Isloch Gaboy. In effect, now, Shaul says to David, in effect, now I owe you money. Because I'm supposed to give you the great wealth, so the problem is that, and you're thinking you can be Makadish with that, but you should realize I'm a Kaddish Milva, ain't a Makudeshus. When a man is Makadish a woman with a loan, that with a previously given loan, then it's not Makudeshus, because then the money is not available right now. Once the loan is given, it's considered as though it's spent. So if you're thinking to be Mekadesh Meirav with that wealth, then that's not going to work. You need to be Mekadesh her with something else, which David didn't do. So therefore, Ozo Yavel Adriel. So instead, Shaul went and married her off to another fellow named Adriel. Dichtiv, as the pasuk says, Vayhi be'es tesis Meirav v'ashol l'David v'gomer, during the time when Meirav was supposed to be given to David in marriage, then instead she was given to Adriel ha'mechilosi. So because Shaul is telling David, you thought you were Mekadesh Meirav, but you were actually mistaken, because it doesn't work that way. And therefore, now years later, David concedes to that. Well, right now, afterwards, when David marries Michal, then it's fine, even though Meirav's alive, because the kedushin were invalid with her. And years later, he also reconfirms that when he says to Ishbosheth that my wife Michal, implying Meirav was never my wife. So Shaul says to David, Ibois to Etan Lacham Michal, fine, if you want to marry my younger daughter Michal, Zil Aisili Meya Orlis Plishtim, go bring me 100 Orlis of Plishtim, go kill 100 Plishtim and cut off their Orlis and bring them to me. Also Aisile, David went and brought him. In fact, the Pasuk says that David even killed 200 Plishtim, but the 100 was what he was supposed to offer. So now Shaul says, wait, that still doesn't work as far as the Kiddushin. I still owe you the Osher Godol, the great wealth, and Milvo Pruta Islach Gaboy. Now, in effect, what it is that I owe you a Milva, but on the other hand, you're offering a Pruta. Because fine, we can assume the Orlis are worth in aggregate at least a Pruta, but nevertheless, that doesn't work. Shaul says, when a man is Makadish with Milva or Pruta, then we say the woman mainly has in mind the Milva. And again, that doesn't work because the Milva has already been given previously, and it's not Be'ain right now. She's not getting an actual tangible benefit right now. In other words, what it is like this. With the Milva, we're saying that if a man has previously lent a woman money, and now he says, I want to be Mekadesh you with that previous loan that I'm going to forgive you, then it doesn't work, because right now she's not receiving any hanah from him. So the same way Shaul is telling Dovin in both these cases, so you're saying you're willing to forego the Osher Gadol, the great wealth, in order to marry my daughter, but it doesn't work that way. And now, even when there's a pruta involved, you are offering the Orlis Plishtim, which are worth a pruta, as the Gemara is going to go work out over here. Then, nevertheless, that doesn't work because she primarily has in mind the milva, and so that still doesn't work as kedushin. The David Savar, now on the other hand, David held milvo pruta daitya pruta, that when you have a milvo pruta over here, she does in fact have in mind the pruta, which is in fact the halacha. So therefore, it was a machlokas in halacha between David and Shaul whether when he was mekadesh michal with these mea orlas plishtim, does it work? So David held yes, which is why later on he's stressing to Ishbosheth that I was mekadesh her mea orlas plishtim. In other words, and therefore it is a fully valid kedushin, and don't question it and give her back to me. On the other hand, Shaul that held that not, which is how, as the Gemara is going to go on to say, he had taken her and given her in marriage to somebody else, Palti ben Laish, because he held that she wasn't married to David in the first place. That's one possibility. The Ibori Sema, another way you could understand the Machlokas, de kula alma milvo pruta daitea pruta, you could say, when there's a milva and a pruta involved, everybody agrees that she does have in mind the pruta. And therefore, for that reason, it should be a valid condition. But Shaul Savar lechazu v'leimidi. Shaul figures the mea orlas plishtim are not actually worth anything monetarily. It may be fine. It shows that David is a mighty heroic guy, but there's no actual monetary value to these. Or the David Savar, whereas David figures chazu lekalvi v'shunri, you could feed them to dogs or to cats, and therefore, so therefore they have a shava pruta. An interesting point in that is that bichlal, we say a mess, the body of a mess is usually also b'hana, and here we're talking about using the orlas plishtim for hana, using them to feed to animals. So the Rashba in that shuvah also deals with a different shuvah actually, where he says that a goyish, a dead body is also b'hana, where here we're saying it's mutter. So well, there's a few possibilities. Maybe he cut off their orlas before they actually died. Maybe he just badly wounded them so they can't resist anymore. Then he cut off their orlas and then they died. Another possibility also is that the Shavus Yaakov brings that an orla is different because it's basically just a piece of skin. Actually, that's Rabbi Yaakov Emden says that. Another answer is that maybe they're considered like his avodim. So there's a few answers over there, but it is negeil halacha. That's one of these things that's brought up in connection with organ transplants and other such things, as far as whether you're allowed to have hana from a mess. There was an interesting thing in the Radvaz's times. They used to grind up Egyptian mummies and use them for medicine, and the Radvaz deals with in one of his shuvahs about whether you're allowed to do that. And there's a lot of discussion about this point about being able to use the body of a dead goy for hana. And one of the Gemaras that factors into that is this one over here. Anyway, so in other words, to Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha is saying that was the whole seder of events, and therefore David was legally married to Michal, but he was not legally married to Merav in the first place, and the fact that Merav is still alive doesn't matter, and he's not over on the issue of two sisters. Well, for Rabbi Yossi, so now the question is, Rabbi Yossi holds that Merav was for a while David's wife, and then she died, and then he married Michal. So hi, tnois ishti es Michal, my dorish bay. So what does he explain? What does he use? How does he explain why David, in his message to Ishbosheth to get back Michal, why is he stressing my wife Michal? Obviously, if he wants it back, if he wants her back, then it means he wants her because she's his wife. So he'd have no reason. So if you say like Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha, then yeah, he has to stress. Look, your father Shaul held she's not my wife. I want you to know that's not the halacha, and she is in fact. But if you say that he married Merav and then he married Michal and he did that after Merav died and there's no issue with the kedushin, then what does Rabbi Yossi have to say about that? What does Rabbi Yossi have to say about the word ishti? So the answer is Rabbi Yossi the Taimei. Rabbi Yossi is actually going according to his own shita, where he says that in fact the pasuk is implying that there was a problem with Merav's marriage to this other guy Adriel. The Tani Rabbi Yossi ha yadurish mikrois meurovin. Rabbi Yossi used to dash in psukim that seemed to be mixed up. Namely like this, Ksiv, you have much later in Sefer Shmuel, you have a story where the Givonim, there was a famine for 3 years, and David asks the Urim V'Tumim, and he's told because Shaul had mistreated the Givonim. He goes to the Givonim to ask them to be Meichel. They said, we want blood, we want 7 descendants of Shaul that we should be able to hang them, and then we'll be Meichel. So who were the 7? So the pasuk says, "Ksiv vayika hamelach shnei bnei Ritzpa bas Aya asher yodel l'Shaul." He took the 2 sons of Ritzpa bas Aya, who was a pilegesh of Shaul. These sons had been born to her and Shaul. As Armoni ves Mephibosheth, their names are Armoni and Mephibosheth. Ves Chameshes bnei Michal, and then there were the 5 sons of Michal asher yodel Adriel.
Hamachilasi v'gomer whom she bore to Adriel Hamachilasi. Now, before we said Adriel was Merav's husband, so v'chila Adriel nitna. The question is, Michal wasn't given in marriage to Adriel. V'alo lepaltish ben Laish nitna. She was given to Palti ben Laish, as the pasuk says, dichtiv v'shol nasenas Michal bita eishes David lefalti ben Laish v'gomer. It says that when David had run away, and again, Shol had held that Michal was never validly married to David, so she takes her and gives her to a man named Palti ben Laish in marriage. So Michal was never Adriel's wife, so why is the pasuk speaking of five sons that Michal bore to Adriel? Ella, so Rabbi Yossi says, what the pasuk implies is, by in effect mixing things up, by making it sound as though Michal was Adriel's wife, when Michal was really David's or Palti's wife, makish kiddushin meirav la'adriel l'kiddushin Michal la'palti. It's making a hekesh between these two marriages. Ma kiddushin Michal lepalti ba'avera. Just like there's no question that the fact that Michal, that Shol accepted kiddushin on Michal's behalf and married her off to Palti, is definitely an avera, because there's no question that David was validly married to Michal, and she can't go be marrying Palti without a get, without either David dying or giving her a get. So there's no question that was an avera. Now, Palti, as the Gemara is going to go on to say over here, he never had relations with Michal. The Gemara is going to go tell later the heroism of Palti in saving himself from Aveda. Nevertheless, it was Baveda in other words, that there was an Aveda involved in Shol being Mekadesh to him. But he says, in other words, had he married and had relations with her, it would have been an Aveda. Anyway, so just like that was Ba'avera, says Rabbi Yossi, Af Kiddushin Meirav La'Adriel Ba'avera, the same way the Kiddushin of Meirav Ta'Adriel are also an Avera, because in fact Rabbi Yossi learns the Kiddushin that Michal, that David did to Meirav were full-fledged Kiddushin. Not like Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha had said before, that he was trying to be Mekadesh only with the milvah and that doesn't work, but rather Rabbi Yossi says it was a full-fledged Kiddushin, and Meirav is every bit David's wife, and now if Shol goes and marries her off to Adriel, then that's an Avera, she's an Eshes Ish. So therefore, so Rabbi Yossi says that's what's implied in the pasuk by calling Michal Adriel's wife, implying that both times when Shol took one of his daughters and married her off to somebody else other than David, then it's an avera to do that. So according to him, that's how it was. David was actually legally married to Merav. Then, how does he marry Michal later on? Because Michal died, and now Merav is available. So the Gemara says, "Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha, Hoksivas Chameshus bnei Michal bas Shol." What about What about Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha? He also. What is he going to say? Hoksivas Chameshus bnei Michal bas Shol. The pasuk does mention the five sons that Michal bore to Adriel, and we know Michal was not married to Adriel. Meirav was. So Rabbi Yossi is learning from that it means that both kedushin were ba'avera, that Shol did something wrong twice. But according to Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha, who says that David was never married to Meirav and she was perfectly entitled to marry Adriel. So what is he doubting from that pasuk? The answer is, Omalach Rabbi Yeshua. Rabbi Yeshua will answer you. It means you have to ask, V'chi Michal Yolda. Never mind the question of whether Michal was married, or who Michal was married to. The pasuk also says that Michal bore these children, but V'halei Merav Yolda. Isn't it actually Merav who was married to Adriel who bore them? Because after all, she was Adriel's wife. Ella, So rather, he says, Meirav Yolda u'Michal Gidla. What it means is that Michal, Meirav gave birth to these children, but she passed away, and then Michal raised them. So Rabbi Yossi had said before that Meirav passed away. That would be even before David married Michal, otherwise he's not allowed to. Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha is saying, I agree that Meirav passed away, but it was a later time after she had five children with Adriel, and now Michal, her sister, raised them. Therefore, these children are called after her name. They're called the sons of Michal, even though they're actually the sons of Merav and Adriel. Which comes to teach you, anybody who raises an orphan in his house, the posuk counts it as though he gave birth to him. So therefore, the posuk credits these children to Michal, even though she wasn't their biological mother, because she raised them. The Rashba, by the way, mentions in his Tshuva over here that also, why does the Pasuk mention this point, Davka over here, when it comes to the Givonim executing several of David, of Shaul's descendants? The point is that it shows how great David was. They're Michal's foster children. And he himself is married to Michal, and the Pasuk makes a point in a couple of times that David really, that David and Michal were really very much in love. So you would think it's his own stepchildren then. How could he, when it comes to the Givonim picking people to be executed, why would David give them up? He should be trying to save them in whatever way possible. But no, he said that the fact is, as the Gemara tells us in Yevamos, it was important to make a public demonstration, to make a Kiddush Hashem after the Chilul Hashem that had been caused by the way Shaul treated the Givonim. Now there has to be a countervailing Kiddush Hashem to see that we take the claims of Geirim, even low-class Geirim like the Givonim, very seriously, and therefore David is not going to interfere. Even you're going to have, it means that his own stepchildren are going to be killed. He's going to still do that in order to take away the Chilul Hashem and bring a Kiddush Hashem instead. So therefore, the Rashba says, that's why the Pasuk over here stresses the point that they were Michal's foster children. So we'll continue tomorrow. Baruch Hashem, the Gemara is going to bring several other sources for this idea that that when a person raises an orphan, then it's considered as though he gave birth to him. We have here the example with Michal and Merab. The Gemara will continue and bring several other such examples from various places in Tanakh.